husband of Mary, father of Theodore and Lester, brother of Patrick and Paul, son of Walter and Nancy, grandson of Frank and Johanna and Gladys and William. And thanks to my finding on the internet someone who'd done all the other work for me, following one line on my mother's side, I could go all the way back to the 12th century in Scotland and Beowulf, the first Laird of Innes. But I won't. My point isn't about genealogical details. It's that my identity is grounded in relationships. And not just family relationships now, husband, father, brother, but my ancestral relationships as well. Even old Beowulf. In a real sense, naming myself means naming my ancestors as well. Except that it doesn't. In the United States, for the majority of us with European ancestry, our arrival in America led to assimilation. And assimilation meant losing our ties to our ancestors. It hasn't always been a thing to be a hyphenated American. In some places, it still isn't. So my father's parents, Frank and Johanna, wanted their children to be Americans. Dad grew up with no working knowledge of Swedish, and when I asked, he had to admit that he really wasn't quite sure what part of Sweden his parents had come from. And it wasn't long before the descendants of James Innes, who came to Virginia from Scotland in the early 1600s, had buried his Scottish identity in the Appalachian soil he now called home. To be sure, there are plenty of folks who have developed an avid interest in their genealogical history. And with the help of Ancestry.com's helpful little leaves, and even more so with just a simple cheek swabbed for DNA and a couple of $100, it's easier than ever to know where we came from. And of course, there are some communities and some cultures in which it has always been important, always been necessary to ground oneself in a sense of tribe. Last week I mentioned some of the differences between so-called I cultures and we cultures. This is another one. And it's not just about the we who are currently around us, it's about the colossally collective we. The we that extends back in time and the we yet to come. And to the extent that a generalized distinction can be drawn, that it's the white dominant culture that tends toward an I orientation and the cultures of people of color that tend toward the we, it's interesting to note that the cultures that are today most strongly we cultures are the ones for whom assimilation was never an option. Something to think about. This month, the question we're exploring is, what does it mean to be a person of ancestry? There are, of course, a number of ways to look at this. Our Unitarian Universalist faith gives us ancestors we can relate to and connect with. Margaret Fuller and her friends Ralph Waldo Emerson and Theodore Parker and Henry David Thoreau and all those transcendentalists, for instance. We are the descendants of their experiments with liberal religion. And there's Dorothea Dix, who fought for the rights of people with mental illness, and Susan B. Anthony, who was one of the prime movers of the 19th century women's suffrage movement. Even Phineas Taylor Barnum, who may be best known for his emporium of largely fake wonders and his contribution to the creation of Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, yet who is also an entrepreneur, urban developer, community benefactor, philanthropist, abolitionist, author, Connecticut legislator, and mayor of the city of Bridgeport, Connecticut, where he is credited with having assisted in ushering in an epoch of unprecedented industrial growth in Connecticut and on the American landscape. Being a person of ancestry, being a Unitarian Universalist person of ancestry could mean learning from and emulating the examples of our religious ancestors who speak to us today. Yet today, in the season when the veil between the living and the dead is at its thinnest, as it said, I think we should focus more on our familial ancestors. Whether it's the Celtic Samhain, Christianity's All Saints and All Souls Days, the Hispanic Dia de los Muertos, Japan's Bon Festival, or the Chinese Yulan Jiwa, all across the globe and throughout all time, we humans have created festivals and rituals for remembering and honoring those who have come before us. Some were designed to protect us from supposedly scary spirits who would do harm to the living. Others were more like a family reunion, sharing together the joy of the ongoing bonds of love in often really awesome parties. Still others are respectful demonstrations of appreciation and gratitude for the many ways one's ancestors have made life today possible. Very different attitudes towards what it means to be in continuing relationship with our ancestors, yet each in their own way is built on the understanding that, to paraphrase Faulkner, the dead are not gone, they're not even dead. How many people here this morning have grown up knowing one or more of your grandparents? Cool. How many have known their great-grandparents? Great-great-grandparents? How many even know their great-great-grandparents' names? This could be something we all do during this month of ancestry. Look into our family's history, learning more than we already know. Of course, family is more than bloodlines. Even those of us who are not genetically related to others in our family are part of each other's histories and herstories. It could be interesting to spend part of our month learning all that we can about it. It could also be a good time to honor these ancestors. Maybe you could build a small shrine like our ancestors' altar, onto which you could place photos and mementos to call those people to mind. My younger son once made a mobile on which he put the name of every one of his relatives. You could do something like that with the names of deceased relatives as well. Now, in a moment, we're going to have an opportunity to call out, or perhaps call into this place, the names of those we would recognize as our ancestors. Now, a little earlier, you received that yellow circle of paper that I mentioned. And with it, we can make a marigold. Some of you may remember that we did this last year, and when we do it again next year, it'll be an old tradition for us. The marigold is a flower that plays a large part in Mexico's Dia de los Muertos celebrations. It's said that its bright colors and sweet scent help to guide the dead back in their visit to the living. So take some time to think of people you've loved who have died, and even those who died before you knew them. Remember that microbial DNA is not the only determinant of family, so anyone who touched your life in such a way that you would remember them now counts. As you think of these people, make small tears around the outside of the circle. Maybe one per person or one per memory that comes to mind. And when you're done, you will have a beautiful paper marigold. So we're going to call out the names after I sound the chime. And when that is done, we will enter a time of prayer and meditation. You're welcome to stay where you are, silently going within, to come forward and light a candle of hope and remembrance, or write in the sands of forgiveness and atonement as we do each week. And you can come forward and place your marigold on the altar. And this is the time Leah mentioned when, if you hadn't put your photo or memento up there, you can do so. And so now, let us move into that quiet place of peace.